Have to hurry today if we get everything in that we're going to get in. Hello, welcome to Pint Like Me. I guess we should say that first, shouldn't we? I'm Phil Parr, in case you hadn't noticed that, in case you didn't know that. Most of you, I imagine, already knew, but anyway, that's who I'm not hiding. That's me. And as I said, we have a lot to do today. Carol Edwards did not get through with her interview last week on the show, and we have a very interesting fellow named Dan Rossi that we're going to talk to today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who just, well, we let him tell you all about what he does. First of all, let me mention our crews that we're getting together. We're coming up on deadline. September 15th is the deadline for the first payment. If you plan to go, we appreciate it. If you'd call me at 936-634-9500. 634-9500. 936-634-9500 is my phone number. Or you can email me at philparr@txucom.net. And let us know that you want to go. We'll give you the travel agent's number. And you can call this lady. Her name is Alicia. She'd be glad to hear from you. And make the first payment, down payment on the cruise. That leaves New Orleans full of blind people on February 29th. I keep forgetting that. February 29th of next year, we'll be sailing from New Orleans. Not sailing. We'll be under big engines, traveling at about 30 knots per hour. Three ports of call, a wonderful cruise. If you want more information, email me or give me a call at, as we said, 936-634-9500. And we'll be glad to give you all the information. All right, with that out of the way, let's go cruising. Let's get back to Carol Edwards, who we were with last week, who's pretty interesting. We'll let her tell you about her story, okay? Good bit of your time. You are involved with some politics in that you are attempting to be put on a committee. Tell us about this.
All righty. When I worked, I've always been the type of person that I've always done volunteer work. I'm a life member of Texas PTA. Conroe School District had honored me with an award one time, but the basis of my volunteering was not to ever be recognized. I love children and I love helping and doing things. There was a bill that passed in Austin in June called House Bill 2292. It will now combine four government agencies. One will be Texas Commission for the Blind. There's one for the aging, one for children and families, and one for mental health. I actually didn't want to see the bill passed, but I have been, through life long enough to know you don't always get everything you want. So now, instead of, being unhappy, I want to try to work to hopefully see that this transition team that's going to make a lot of these changes that will impact so many people's lives do the best that they can for anyone that is their consumer or their future consumers. Because a little corny saying I have is, in the blink of an eye, my life changed drastically.
Yes.
And it can happen to anybody. And you never know when you may need a service that is offered. My hardest thing, and I discovered with everybody, was to ask for help because I had worked and been very independent.
You didn't need any help.
That's right.
Or you thought you didn't.
Well, that's right. And if I did, I went and got a second job and I'd help myself. So my thing is, it's very hard for someone to ask for help. My goal is to hopefully bring some insight and some depth to the transition team if I am able to be appointed to it. I'm a very fair person. In PTA, I learned the word inclusion. I'm very good at making sure everybody's included. They are updated. They're aware of anything. Anything I know, I'll let someone else know.
Uh-huh.
But I, like I said, I'm a very fair person and I'm very honest. And so my thing is, even though I didn't want to see this passed, I will work as hard as I can to make sure that what this new commission is all about will do the best it can do for the people it needs to serve.
Now, is there a planned committee, or is the committee your idea?
Oh, no, it's a transition team that Governor Rick Perry will appoint. And what I did is I just wrote some letters. Actually, I called the governor's office the day I found out the bill had passed, and I asked if they would let Governor Perry know that I would like him to veto the bill. But as my kids, he probably wouldn't listen to me, you know, even though I thought it was a good idea, which I am joking right now. But afterwards, I sent a letter and asked if there was any type of a committee, or I didn't realize it was going to be called a transition team. I said, if there was a committee formed to help implement this new commission, I would like to be considered for this committee. And I received a paper thanking me for my interest and sending me the paperwork that I need to fill out and send back.
Which you did.
Actually, I'm working on it now. I just received it a week ago. And I actually, it's kind of like a job interview, and it's taken me a few days to do a resume. I haven't done one for about 15 or 16 mm-hmm. years. So I've also contacted people that I've known through the years, that I've worked with in volunteer work, that I've worked with in business. I've contacted some of my elected officials, and I've asked for letters to be sent on my behalf. Being an ordinary citizen that's never asked to do this, I feel like that would maybe help Governor Perry feel more comfortable to know that I am the type of person that works very hard and I take things seriously. So I'm in the process of getting everything together to get it mailed back.
Okay, why don't we do this? We're about out of time. Why don't we think about this and maybe... I don't know when the deadline will be for the formation of this commission, mm-hmm. but why don't we maybe in a month or so check back with you and see if you got appointed, and maybe you can kind of keep us up if you do get appointed with what they're doing, with what the commission is attempting to do.
And I would be very glad to do that.
Because, of course, this only affects Texas, mm-hmm. and that's where we live, so that is of great interest to us. But there are a lot of Texans who listen to ACB radio, and by the time this is on, we'll be on Houston taping. So
I would like to add one thing when you say that it only affects Texas. People need to realize that this is happening all through the United States because in every state they're tight. And so that's when they'll start trying to make cuts, which, you know, we only have so much money to work with. But even though this is Texas that I'm in and I'm dealing with, everyone in every state needs to be aware of what's going on in their state and just remember that they may be, like me, an ordinary citizen, but if you say something and you pursue it and you work, hopefully you can make a difference. You know, if you sit back and whine and complain, you're never going to make a difference.
Let me go, because we're about out of time, and I will check with you in a month or so and see if you got on the committee, and maybe if you did, you can tell us what they're doing or not doing, and we can get some information that way. Good?
I sure will. Look forward to talking to you, and thank you for talking to me today.
Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now with this week's Blind Sight, here's Don Shaw.
You know, if you're an old scanner listener, and I'm talking audio scanner now, like myself, you know, you used to be limited on your scanner listening to the city, basically, that you were in, whether you listened to police, fire, emergency medical, amateur radio, whatever you were kind of into listening on your scanner. You know, before the internet days, you were, again, very limited on what you could listen to. Not anymore. Not with the day of the internet. I found a site. It's called policescanner.com, and it has a lot of different cities around the United States listed that they have that you can click on and go to that city and listen to some police scanner channels from there. There's some aircraft monitoring from some different airports around the United States. Man, for a scanner listener that kind of wants to add to their scanner listening experience, this may be a place you would want to check out. We have come ways from listening to things in our own city. I would give this site a screen reader friendliness rating of a 6 or so. Not the easiest site to navigate around on, but it's a worthwhile site if you're a scanner listener. If you want to check it out, go to www.police-scanner.info/livescan.htm. Until next time, I'm Don Shaw. Keep on web sightin'.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
We are visiting with Dan Rossi from Pittsburgh, who resides in, maybe not from, but who resides at this point in time in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, right?
Correct.
Where the convention was.
That's right, just a couple of weeks ago.
So you didn't have far to go, did you?
No, it was pretty easy. Just hopped on the bus and I was down there in a couple of minutes.
And how long have you lived in Pittsburgh?
On and off for the last 18 years. I've been here probably 13 out of those 18 years.
But this is not home. This, you didn't start out, is it?
No, I grew up on Long Island, New York.
That's what I wanted to get to. Your early years. If you don't mind me asking, what age you are?
I am 36.
36, just a child.
Just a babe.
Well, compared to us old men who do this handyman show, you grew up, or you were born in your formative years were in Long Island, you say?
Yeah, Long Island, New York. Born and raised, and was there until I was 18 when I left for school in Pittsburgh.
Now what visual acuity do you have?
So I am totally blind now. Both eyes are prosthetic.
Uh-huh.
I was born with cancer, retinoblastoma. Discovered at the age of 3, lost my left eye immediately, and then spent 4 years, bunch of surgeries, in and out of the hospital all the time, trying to save the right eye, but eventually lost that battle at the age of 7, and they removed my right eye, and so I've been totally blind ever since then.
But until you were 3, you weren't aware that you had any vision problem, is that right?
Correct. The doctors assumed that I never saw out of my left eye because the tumor had completely invaded the orb, and it just nobody ever noticed it until I was 3, and it was just actually an accident. My brother and cousins and I were playing, and they thought they saw something in my eye, and my parents started taking me to doctors, and that's when they found out.
It's amazing.
But I could see fine out of my right eye almost right up until the end.
But you didn't know.
No, I didn't know. Nobody did.
You had no way of knowing that something wasn't right because you had no frame of reference.
Exactly. I didn't know any better.
That's interesting. And at 3, you realized, I guess you don't remember this, but they realized you had a problem, and by 7 years old, you were total.
Yeah, I had pretty good vision up until the last few months. They used to call me Hawkeye because my one good eye was pretty good. I could see, I could see fine.
See, that's amazing.
In the last few months before they removed my right eye, the tumor was starting to throw some shadows and reflections, and it was causing some vision trouble. And I did wear glasses, but only for a short period of time before they removed the right eye.
So we have this blind fellow that they call Hawkeye. See, that's knocked out. You have conceptions of what sight is.
Yeah, I have excellent visual recollections. I mean, from the time you're 7, you've got pretty good visual memories from then. And I mean, I've got crystal clear visual recollections of scenes and images, and from that I just build all the new ones that I need, so I can picture my office or my house or the new people I meet, build faces for them. So it's kind of a continual thing. In a sense, I can still see a lot in my head. I don't think I could have gotten my mechanical engineering degree had I not had sight for those 7 years, because, I mean, it's a fairly somewhat visual field, and I believe that being able to imagine in things that are described to me was pretty much essential. I was very lucky. Growing up on Long Island, the public school that I started in was a fairly well-to-do school district, a very large school district, and covered a bunch of the little towns out there on the island. I mean, there must have been, you know, eight towns covered under the Sachem School District. And so when we knew that I was going to lose my right eye, and the principal of my elementary school at that time was, he was very much wanted me to stay in his school.
Mm-hmm.
And so he really went to bat for me. He got everything set up for me. He got a Braille instructor and a mobility instructor, and they kept me in the public school, and I stayed there right through high school.
Well, at the time you were born, at the time you were growing up, when you were seven, you were born, what, 65, 66?
67.
67. So we're looking at mid-70s. They were beginning a whole lot more to what they call now mainstreaming.
Sure.
So you never touched, you never spent any time at all at a blind school?
No, I never did. And you know, it was kind of... in the attitude of the time, it was frowned upon, really. I mean, from where I grew up on Long Island, anyway.
What was frowned upon? Not going to blind school?
Well, yeah. Well, they didn't. Nobody wanted to send me to a blind school because they thought that was a stigma. You know, if you go to a blind school, you're not going to get a good education. You're never going to, you know, you need to be mainstreamed. And I think that was part of that time. You know, mainstreaming, it was the way to go. My parents had considered moving to Colorado, but found out that they wouldn't mainstream me in Colorado. So they said, no, we're not gonna move and put you in a school for the blind. But I don't really, as I've gotten older, I'm not sure I feel that same stigma anymore.
Yeah.
If a public school isn't really set up for a blind student, it can be very difficult.
Sure, it could be.
Yeah. So I got lucky because my public school was, they really went to the wall for me. They got me everything I needed, and so it wasn't a huge challenge. Only when I got to college did it become really an issue.
Well, as you said, you had an advocate. You had someone who my blind school experience was bad, but then I talked to a lot of people who just, I had a wonderful time at the blind school. You know,
right.
And I think educationally probably it would be all right. It's just that you were hundreds of miles from your family. And
right.
That was the, you know, as I felt like at age six that not only was I blind, but I was being punished for it.
Sure.
And somebody was punishing me because I was blind. It was something, and it really took me a long time to get past that. Okay, so you went from being a and I guess they taught you to read as a child, didn't they?
Yes.
Taught you to?
Yeah, I actually, because they knew I was going to lose my sight. I mean, we knew that it was a possibility from the time I lost my left eye. So,
yeah.
I actually started taking reading lessons in kindergarten. And started reading in kindergarten before my classmates, just because they wanted to expose me to it prior to losing my right eye.
Oh, what wonderful progressive thinking!
It really was. It really was at the time.
Sure, it was, because I've got the same. I have no conception of print material. No. It means nothing to me.
Sure. I still see often when I think of words or sentences, I still see them in print letters in my head.
And you are still building, like you said, when you meet somebody, you put a face with them.
I do.
That's amazing. We'd have to discuss that with some other people who have had a kind of a close experience to yours.
Mm-hmm.
And when you dream, can you see?
You know, it's odd. It's hard to remember your dreams specifically enough. I don't think I actually see in my dreams. I see like I see now.
Okay.
More of an image than actually seeing something. So when I sit in my office, I imagine my office setting and where things are on my desk, but I don't actually see them. And I think it's similar in a dream. It's somewhat vague in that, you know where objects are, but I don't think you have the clarity of a concentrated image.
Dan, let's take a short break.
Sure.
And we've got you in middle school, I guess, now, and so we'll move along to high school in just a minute. More of the Blind Handyman coming up. We are back with Dan Rossi. I said the Blind Handyman. Actually, this is Blind Like Me. I'm confused. Well, it is Monday. We talked about that, didn't we? Yeah.
That's right. Monday. Monday's a tough day.
So you went on to high school at this same school system with this same advocate who was helping you. They taught you Braille.
Yes, I learned Braille right from the beginning. Actually, I started learning Braille before I lost my right eye. So I had a good background in Braille. I still read Braille today. I'm not a fast Braille reader by any means, but I still use it every day.
Have you ever read a library book in Braille, a novel?
Yes, I've read several.
Have you? Yeah. Well, then you're a lot faster than me, because I
know. It takes a while, but I do read it. The last book I read was in Braille was Eric Weinmayer's Touch the Top of the World. It was being sold by National Braille Press, and it was on the endangered book list, so I figured I'd get a copy before it was gone.
Well, I think, because we won't dwell on this either, because it's another show. I think there are people who have. I never will have the ability to read Braille. I can't read it. I cannot, and I've tried. I can't discern when I finish a line and I slide my hand back. I don't know, have any idea where am I? What was the first word in the last line? I cannot grasp it. And my brother could read. My brother used to read the Bible to my mother.
Uh-huh.
He was that fast and that good. And
wow.
There are a lot of Braille readers like that. But that's for another show. So you did high school with Braille or with both?
With both. Braille, tape. I had a Braille instructor, or itinerant teacher, whose job it was to do all the translating to and from Braille and print for me, would record things for me, when I had to read a book for in elementary school, and later years if I had to read books for research papers and stuff. He would do a lot of the reading for me, and so it made it very accessible. School was very accessible.
All right. What was your relationship with your peers, with folks with other students?
I think I had your pretty run of the mill experiences growing up. I was in the Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. I wrestled for one or two years, I don't even remember now, back in junior high school, but I was a terrible wrestler. But I did it because I wanted to be in some sport.
Yeah.
I skied with our ski club and my friends, and we all learned to ski together. And
now, you're talking about downhill ski?
That was downhill ski, yeah.
Wow.
And growing up in the, essentially Northeast, it was fairly popular. So I learned to do that and had to overcome some hurdles with, the school not wanting to let me go at first. But
sure.
My guidance counselor was a big skier, so he backed me on that. He was a great guy, and he helped me out all through getting the school to agree to let me go skiing. And I think in general with my peers, I was just, I had my circle of friends or a couple of different circles of friends, and I think I was just one of the other characters in school.
Yeah, but I'm sure they had some insurance issues with blind Dan. Yeah.
Probably. I don't think I ever saw that part of it, but I'm sure that's what was going on behind the scenes.
I imagine. And you weren't a good wrestler, but that had nothing to do with you being blind.
No, that just had a lot to do with me being a lousy wrestler.
Yeah, because we had wrestling teams at school that were just killer. I mean, just kicking butt all over the place.
Yep.
So high school was a good experience for you? You enjoyed it?
I think it was a good experience. It wasn't a bad experience. I was very happy to be done with high school and moving on to something new. new.
Yeah.
But I think overall it wasn't a bad experience.
Well, I think that's normal. Kids
yeah.
want to be through with all the politics and all the BS that goes along with high school. You're glad to be over with it.
Sure, sure.
All right. Did you early decisions you may have made as to a career path? What were you thinking when you were a teenager, right, that you might want to do for gainful employment when you grew up?
I think like most teenagers, I wanted to do a lot of different things and didn't really have a good idea. I figured I was going to be an engineer of some sort because I was good in math and science. I really enjoyed math and science, so I figured that was the direction I was going to take. And I had applied to different universities under different engineering degree programs. I applied for aerospace engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, and computer science. And I ended up getting into Carnegie Mellon, into the School of Engineering, but had to determine after I got here which field I was going to take. And it turned out to be mechanical engineering, which I thought that's really where I wanted to be because I wanted to be in the aerospace industry.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that at some point. And so mechanical engineering was the way to go at Carnegie Mellon anyway. And so I was really excited to do that. And I wasn't quite prepared for what that entailed, getting a mechanical engineering degree at a top-ranked university as a blind student at a university that was not ready for a blind student, and that caused a lot of trouble. But
there was no box on the application that said how well do you see.
Exactly.
Oh, because if they didn't, when you applied and they accepted you, did they know?
Yeah, I think it probably written in my essay, my school essay, that you know you had to write essays for all the applications. It probably was in there. On some of the applications, same thing later when I was looking for jobs. Sometimes I would say I was blind, and sometimes I would say I wasn't, or not say it, to see the different reactions. I think Carnegie Mellon probably knew, but they just did not have any. They had never had a blind student at the university before, so they just had no baseline of what to do.
Okay, but they took you knowing you were blind.
Yes, yes.
That's what I was trying to get. I was a disc jockey for years, and I applied for a job in Dallas, and the guy called me back the day I got my tape and said, Phil, can you be here next Monday? And I said, well, I might be able to be, but there's something you probably ought to know before I come. You need to call the guy I'm working for now. So he called me. Of course, he never called me back.
Oh, really?
No, he never did. I was, in retrospect, I'm glad he didn't, but it really hurt.
Sure.
Then, because I was essentially doing the job in the Houston market that he wanted me to do in Dallas, I could have done his job.
Right.
And obviously was good enough to handle it, or he wouldn't have called me. So
right.
they took you knowing that you were blind. So this was there had to be some decision there made. Do we think we can handle this, or is this guy obviously is very bright, and we think we can do this? Let's try it. Or did you have an advocate there, or do you don't have any idea? They just...
No, I didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. And actually, you know, it has not crossed my mind, but I see every day in the gym, I see the vice provost of enrollment, and I've never really thought to ask him about if he remembers my application going through, or... But I should talk to them about it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, because this is something that Carnegie Mellon had never done.
Right. They had never had a totally blind student.
So this was your first year. This, of course, is a four-year institution. You were going to do all 4 years there.
Yep.
And I would imagine that not being prepared, because college work is, you know, we talked to a guy yesterday, like it was talking about how he breezed through high school, and college just, I mean, he just crashed him.
That's exactly what happened with me.
He didn't realize he was actually going to have to study now.
College destroyed me, and partly it was my own arrogance that I was going to get through here without any problems. I was going to, just like high school, I had no trouble getting through high school, and I did very well. And I assumed the same thing for college. I would get through. And aside from the fact that it was a very tough university, all of the support I had had in high school was no longer there. Yeah. I didn't have someone whose job it was to read exams to me or read textbooks to me that weren't recorded. My textbooks were basically after my freshman year were never available because the lead time on getting books recorded from RFB for a technical book
was six months.
No, it was 2 years.
Good heavens.
2 years for an engineering text. So there was just no chance of getting textbooks, and so I had to depend 100% on readers, and the people who were best qualified to read those books were other engineering students who were great for the first few weeks of the semester and then disappeared once midterms hit because they were doing the same thing I was, and they were busy.
They had their own issues.
Exactly.
Things to take care of.
And so I tried to hang in there, and I refused to believe that I wasn't going to get out in 4 years. I refused to believe that I couldn't handle a full load of technical classes each semester, and so I would sign up for everything that everybody else was doing, and consequently, rather than concentrating on a couple, two of the five classes and finishing them, I would take, you know, five of five and screw them all up. Although typically I would get through one class a semester because I had four technical classes and one non-technical class each semester. And the technical ones, I just screwed up left and right, took incompletes, just couldn't get through them. And the professors were all very understanding, but there wasn't a whole lot they could do to help.
There wasn't a student advisor or counselor or anybody who would be mature enough to say, hey, if you took less, maybe...
Thinking back, the dean of Carnegie Institute of Technology, who was a great guy who really helped me out, was probably trying to steer me in that direction, but I was just too stubborn to believe it. I was too stubborn to believe that I couldn't do it. And it, consequently, what I could have gotten through in probably 6 years, being reasonable without killing myself, I could have done it in 6 years. Instead, I ended up leaving twice to go work for a while and then come back to finish up some classes. And it took me 9 years to get my degree.
So you were 8 feet tall and bulletproof, and they weren't going to tell you how to go to college.
Exactly.
You could do it good as those sighted kids, and by God, you were going to... Yeah, well, I've been there. We've all... I got grandkids now that are that absolutely that way. So it took you 9 years to get this degree that... that a lot of people get in 4 years.
Exactly.
But it would be a tough degree to get in 4 years, even if you could see, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Having recently talked to Bill Elliott, the provost of enrollment here, he was saying that it's becoming less and less, or I guess it's becoming more popular to do it in 5 years. We have probably 10% of the class goes 5 years now.
Yeah.
So it's a tough degree. All the degrees are tough to finish in 4 years now.
So you were 27 or so, 26 or 7 when you finally completed this degree.
Yep.
From Carnegie Mellon. Just as an aside, what sort of things did you do? You say you went off and worked. What did you do when you?
So I got lucky. After 4 years here, I applied for a summer internship at the NASA Lewis Research Center.
Oh, man.
In Cleveland, Ohio.
And they accepted you?
They accepted me, and I did hear a little more about the process that went on behind the scenes when they got my resume.
Yeah.
They looked at it, and the guy who was in charge of summer interns had it sitting on his desk, and one day one of the branch chiefs came in, and the summer intern guy said, well, what would you do with this guy? And he handed him my resume, and Gary said, well, I'd call him up and I'd find out what he was capable of doing and how he did what he's done so far, and bring him in for an interview. And
yeah,
that's exactly what happened. And I ended up working in Gary Helford's branch at NASA, and they knew the score, and I had told them what was going on at school and that I had been burnt out and that I was going to take a year off. And they worked with me and actually pulled me in on a short-term contract. So I ended up working with them for another stint. I worked with them for 4 or 5 months as an intern, and then had to take some time off, and then the short-term contract kicked in, and I worked for them for another 6 months before coming back to school.
Now, I'm trying to calculate. We were up now into the late 80s.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to get to is, did we have accessible computers by then?
Oh, yeah. When I came to school, the New York State Commission for the Blind, having grown up in New York, they dumped a ton of money into me. And so when I came to school in 85, I had an accessible computer.
In 85?
In 85. I was using a speech synthesizer called a Provert, which I loved, and it was almost the size of a desktop computer. and I had software from Telesensory. It wasn't Softvert then. I think it was Vert Plus, I think, was the software.
Were you still booting with a cassette? I mean, how?
New York State bought me one of the first quote unquote portable computers. It was bigger than my desktop. It had a little five inch monitor built into it and two floppy drives, no hard disk.
Oh, but
so
it had
you
a floppy
booted
drive.
Off a floppy.
Yeah.
And it was state-of-the-art stuff back then.
When you booted off a floppy, it was state-of-the-art, because everybody else with their little Apple IIe's, they were booting from cassettes, you know,
yep.
Storing the information on cassettes.
So I had gotten involved in accessible computers early on. So
by the time you worked for NASA, you had computers were becoming fairly common then.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that was my job. When I went to work for NASA, I was basically doing programming work, writing computer models of composite materials. And my job was basically programming for them, so I was on the computer all day.
Boy, that's heady stuff in 1987, man. you know about lots of blind folks as programmers today. There are a lot of them, but in 19—man, that's— That's wow for that time. So you had a pretty good head start, really, on some blind people.
I did. I mean, I was lucky in a lot of ways, and I was involved early on. So
that NASA break was the luckiest thing that ever happened to you.
It really was. It really was a fantastic break for me. As a kind of an interesting aside to that, and one of the frustrating things about looking for jobs as a blind person, I had also applied to Grumman in Bethpage, New York, on Long Island, near where I used to live. And I had an in, I had a contact, and I had sent a resume. And they contacted me, like, I don't know, maybe it was in June. I'd already been working at NASA for a month.
Mm-hmm.
I applied to them for a summer intern, and they said that, you know, they had a position available for me, and they were really apologetic for why it had taken so long, but they were, you know, trying to figure out things like how I would get to and from work and everything. And I was so mad at them because they had offered me a great job, you know, and I would have considered the job. But, you know, getting to and from work was not their problem. That was my problem. And to think that people would make those decisions for me or be trying to make those decisions for me, I was really annoyed.
And
but it turned out for the better anyway, because NASA was a great experience.
I did at one time some talking to Texas Association of Broadcasters and NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, meetings about blind people in radio, and my thinking was if there is a problem that you have with equipment and something to do at the radio station, don't worry about solving it. Let them solve it.
Right.
They'll solve that problem. You don't need to, you know, you may need to assist them. You may need to tell them where the meter is when it makes this noise, but if you'll tell the guy once, he'll remember that. You won't have to tell him twice. And he, if he's a blind person that's going to make it as a blind person, let him solve him or her solve the problem.
Right.
Like you said, getting to work was not their issue.
No, that was my issue, and it had nothing to do with my ability to perform the job. You know, that was something I would have to solve myself.
Well, as usual, I'm spending too much time, but this has gone very well as far as I'm concerned. We've gotten a good insight into you and your life, and part of this is educational. We intend to give this series to school districts or anybody that's teaching blind children to show them that things can be done. Let's take a little short break and get you out of college and get you into some working. And we haven't really discussed. Let's get you in the sky, okay?
Okay.
Hang on just a sec. All right, back to Dan Rossi. More blind like me. You finished this internship at NASA. You went back to college, got your degree. Completed
yep.
your studies at Carnegie Mellon University.
Correct.
And then I think you said when you wrote me that you couldn't find anybody that would hire you with your degree. Let's get into that.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. I was convinced that once I had the mechanical engineering degree from this university that getting the job would not be a major issue.
People would see
that I had the degree from a great university. I could obviously do the job.
Yeah.
Didn't work out that way.
Okay.
I sent out hundreds of resumes, did dozens of interviews, and just never got anywhere. Now, I'm not saying I was the greatest student, and the fact that it took me 9 years didn't help, but I still thought I would be able to pull it off. But after searching for a long time, I could not find a job to fit me.
Do you think that as you said, you thought once you got the degree it would be no problem. Do you think that came through? I mean, do you think any of this was due to your attitude?
What do you mean by do I?
I mean, were you projecting the right? Where I'm trying to go is maybe the right degree of humility or the right degree of I think I can do this, give me a shot, or were you saying, by God, I can, and you'll be lucky to get me.
I think I was trying to project the latter. I think I was trying to project that, hey, I got this degree. I deserve to be sitting in this interview chair, and I've done what it takes to get here, and I'm as equally as qualified as anybody else who's sitting here.
Sometimes sighted people have a hard time dealing with that coming from a blind person.
They really do.
Not that you should. Not that to thine own self be true. I believe it greatly, but a lot of times you gotta roll with the punches.
I think you're right. I mean, I think to a certain extent, and I found in other endeavors in my life that sometimes you need to play the game.
Yeah.
You got to play the game, and you can't just walk up to everybody and say, "I'm blind, and you can't tell me I can't do this. I'm going to do that." And sometimes you just got to play and bring people along with you.
Well, you got to get in the door before you can show them your stuff.
Exactly.
I discovered that at an early age. Anyway, there came a day when you realized, I'm not going to be able to get a job with this degree. I'm going to have to do something. Were you back with your parents, back at home? Or?
No, I basically, when I left New York summer of 1985 to come to Pittsburgh,
yeah.
That was the last time I lived with my parents. They moved immediately after I left moved to Florida. And so there really was no home to go to at that point because I didn't have any friends or anything in Florida.
Mm.
So I stayed at school during the summers and, I just kind of kept going from there.
Okay.
And so after I realized I wasn't getting a job, I started looking for any job I could get, and I ended up with National Industries for the Blind. And with an intern type program, and got sent to their tech center in St. Louis, Missouri. And I worked there for a year doing manufacturing consulting, which was not exactly mechanical engineering, but it was not bad. It was helping other agencies, the lighthouses and such, determine what projects they could do, and then helping them source materials and sub-manufacturers for parts and stuff. That wasn't bad, but I knew it was a temporary job, and I ended up interviewing with some of the lighthouses that I had consulted with and got hired by Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind, and moved up to Seattle, Washington, and was doing similar type work there, only specifically for the Seattle Lighthouse. So I was doing a lot of sourcing of materials and new product development, and some parts of it were a lot of fun. I mean, you know, they'd say, Dan, we want to start producing business cards for the federal government. We want to get this contract to produce business cards for the entire federal government. So find out what it's going to take and get us set up. And
okay.
Here's $500,000 and go buy us printing presses and whatever else we need. And so,
okay, so they would figure out something that they, a contract they could get, and then they needed to figure out how to do it.
Exactly.
Okay.
A lot of the stuff we were already did, you know, we would look through the Federal Register for products that we were already making similar products. We did a lot of injection molded plastics and mm-hmm. sewn products and cut materials, phenolic cut materials, because we were a huge subcontractor for Boeing. Boeing, we did a lot of work for Boeing out there and making parts for Boeing. So we had a lot of high-end, I mean, it was a very sophisticated machine shop.
Yeah.
We had a lot of, computer numerically controlled milling equipment and, high-end injection molding machines and water jet cutting machines and all kinds of spiffy stuff.
So it was a little more than putting nuts and bolts in envelopes.
It really was. I mean, we certainly had those types of jobs because the Seattle Lighthouse hired visually impaired and multiple disabled people. So
okay.
There were a lot of people there who were mentally disabled as well as visually impaired. And they did some of those simpler type jobs. But we also had some pretty pretty sharp guys on some of the milling equipment.
See, I haven't been to a lighthouse in a long time, and it was just a joke. The last one I went to was back in the 60s, and it was just, you know, there was a couple guys caning chairs and making a few mops, and I thought, geez, this is not where I need. I don't need to be here, you know?
Right. And I mean, I still have mixed emotions about the lighthouse and myself working at the lighthouse. I was uncomfortable with it at first because I felt it was a stigma or a statement on me that, you know, that's all I could do. I could only work for an organization for the blind because nobody else would hire me.
Let me qualify this by saying there's nothing wrong with making mops. I didn't want to do it.
Right. That's just it. I talked to, and I think what changed part of my attitude was talking to a lot of the people that were there. I mean, a lot of the people I talked to, you know, they were happy to be doing what they were doing. They had a job. They were good at their job. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, injection molding and stuff, that's the job. I mean, it's a relatively uncomplicated job, but, you know, it's not only blind people who are doing it. There's hundreds of, you know, thousands of injection molded shops around the country. And there's sighted people doing exactly at these other shops what the blind people were doing at Seattle Lighthouse.
So you stayed there how long?
I was just there for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And then I decided that I just wasn't happy doing what I was doing there. Mm-hmm. And I was considering grad school, and I had applied to a couple of grad schools, but I had been taking some programming classes at the University of Washington, and a friend of mine back here in Pittsburgh said, "Slip me your resume. We've got a position for a company then called TransArc, which was a subsidiary of IBM." And he handed my resume in, and they called me, and originally they said no, and that's when I had applied to grad school. And then they called me months later and said, "Hey, you still interested in this job?"
Yeah.
Sure. And so I flew out to Pittsburgh, interviewed all day, and it was probably the best position I had ever been in for an interview, because I had a job. I already had a job. I had an acceptance from a grad school that was going to, you know, pay my way plus a stipend. Mm-hmm. So I basically was able to tell them, hey, I've got all this, so you guys have to come across with some good money if you really want me here. So
always easier to find a job if you've got a job.
Exactly, exactly. So they did, and they lured me into Pittsburgh.
And that's where you are now?
I've changed jobs now since then, but I worked for TransArc for a year before they were absorbed by IBM. So then I was working for IBM for almost 2 years, and then I was approached by Carnegie Mellon for a job here.
Mm-hmm.
So I find myself back now at Carnegie Mellon.
Doing what?
I am a database administrator. I manage Oracle databases for the university. So I do installations of databases, maintenance, backup, upgrades. Often I consult for other departments in the university on database issues, database security. So I spend my whole day sitting in my office banging on a computer, convincing computers to do things
what you want them to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Things could be worse, Dan. All right, I wanted to spend a lot more time on this. Unfortunately, we're down to about 5 minutes. I always do this. I do, every time I've done 8 or 10 of these, I always do this. Let's get into what we want to talk about. You're diving, so
okay.
Just go from the first and run me through that.
Okay, so I was 16, and I guess I had talked a lot about skydiving. I had seen it on TV when I still had sight, and it always looked interesting. And when I was 16, I got the opportunity to try it out and make my first skydive. And I did. I had to have my parents' permission because you had to be 18 to sign the waivers.
Well, sighted kids had to have it too, though, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, everybody did.
Okay.
If you're 16, you had to get your parents to sign the papers. So they did, and so that was 1983. I made my first jump. 20 years later or now, I've made about 300 jumps, and it's... like I was saying earlier about taking people along slowly, that's what I had to do when I started to free fall. The instructors asked me, well, you know, what do you really want to get out of skydiving? And I had to go pretty easy because at the time I wanted to say, well, I want to do everything. I want to do, you know, formation jumps, and I want to do, canopy relative work where you're flying canopies, you open your parachute and you dock your parachute with someone else. I wanted to do it all.
Yeah.
And but I told them a lot simpler story, that I wanted to just be able to exit the plane solo and be docked on by somebody else in free fall, and that was it. And they thought that was a reasonable goal, and a few jumps later we were doing that, and then we started talking about doing some other stuff and, you know, more people in free fall and trying to build different formations. And a few jumps later, we were doing that. And, you know, after a while, I was just another skydiver, which is doing everything I wanted to do. And so it was just a matter of not getting in people's face and telling them that I was going to do everything and they weren't going to stop me. So I brought them along at the pace that was comfortable for everybody. And yeah. I got to where I wanted to go.
I'm going to ask some ignorant questions, but that's all right. I know nothing about skydiving. How did you know all these things were possible? Had you seen these before you lost your sight?
I had seen some of them before I lost my sight. And then once you start getting involved in the skydiving community, you hear and talk to people, and skydivers love to tell stories and love to tell tales of, you know, what happened on this jump or that jump. So you learn a lot, and I picked up on all of that. So I wanted to do what everybody else was doing.
And so you've made, you say, how many?
About 300 skydives now.
300 skydives.
Yeah.
So if you want to skydive, what do you do? I mean, there's a place that will let you do that on the weekends. Of course, you have.
Yeah, you have to go to a, you know, it's called the drop zone. And they're all over the country, different drop zones. Some may be more willing to let a blind person jump than others. I've been turned away from certain drop zones. John Fleming, who is another blind skydiver, as far as we know, we are the two active blind skydivers.
The only two you know about?
The only two we know about.
Okay.
And I know that there are some other blind people who have made jumps, and even a couple who are trying to get involved in the sport. But right now, John and I are the two experienced active skydivers, and he's been turned away from drop zones, and I've been turned away from drop zones. But, you know, we go where we're wanted, you know. And the skydiving community, the people are fantastic. So they are often very willing to help and very interested in working with me. So I've had a great experience, really.
All right, and when you are landing, of course, you don't have to link with somebody now. You can jump
sure.
out of the plane and land
yep.
on you can land on your own. You don't have to dock with somebody.
No, and I use radios. Once my parachute's open, I'm on radios, just like students are. Anybody who jumps out of a plane for the first time solo is on radios. Somebody's talking to them from the ground, telling them which way to turn and when to prepare to land. And so I just use radios all the time. And it works pretty well most of the time.
Well, okay. What do you mean most of the time? Now you've got to tell us what do you mean by that.
I know we're short on time, but there's a...
But that's fine. I've got to hear this story. Go.
I have a saying, flare when you hear the crickets. When you're coming in for a landing, you flare your parachute out. You slow it down so that you can have a nice soft landing.
Yeah.
And a couple of times I've been out there without radios. And either the radios have failed or the radio man has failed and forgotten about me, and I've had to land my parachute solo with no help. And the first time it happened, I had heard crickets on the ground chirping. It was getting toward evening,
and it was time to open it then.
Well, it was open, but it was time to land, you know. And I crashed and burned that landing, and that's where the joke started. Well, I should have flared when I heard the crickets. And
yeah.
then a year later, I was out there on my own again, and I was coming in, and I heard the crickets, and I got my canopy flared out and had a beautiful landing. And so it kind of became legend after that. There's been some other times that it hasn't worked out quite so smoothly. I was injured in an accident 3 years ago where I was landing off the drop zone because of we had gotten out of the plane at kind of the wrong spot, and I wasn't going to make the landing area, and I hit some trees, and I got pretty badly banged up, but not too badly.
But you've been up many times since then.
Yes, I've been back in the air since then.
Didn't scare you off. Do you have a, in case anyone's listening that is interested in this kind of thing, are you interested in corresponding with blind people who want to do this sort of thing? Or you...
Certainly. As a matter of fact, I've been in correspondence with two blind people in the last year who have tracked me down, who wanted to learn to skydive and needed some information. And as a matter of fact, that's how I met Eric Weinmayer. He tracked me down like 10 years ago trying to find out about skydiving.
Yeah.
And so I'd be more than...
Do you have an email address that you can just give and maybe
sure.
somebody was interested, they wanted to contact you?
I am dr25 at Andrew, A-N-D-R-E-W, .cmu.edu.
Right, do it one more time.
DR Delta Romeo 25 at andrew.cmu.edu.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll get some interest going, and maybe within a year you'll have a listserv up for the blinds. It's not out of the question. I wouldn't think. Who'd have thought this blind handyman thing would take off?
That's true.
Of course, a lot more guys hammer nails than...
hey, and I give those guys a credit because I'm not the greatest handyman, but I'm trying to learn.
Well, listen to those shows, and you still won't be the greatest.